and welcome to this week's dialect. Hello and welcome to Dialect. The show is coming to you from Bristol City Centre and is part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol, our listeners on Preston FM, that's 103.2 up there in Preston, and our listeners in Swindon and also Radio Verulam in St Albans.
Also, hello and congratulations to Radio Winchcombe. They just got their full licence to start broadcasting on a daily basis. In the studio this week, we have Jamie Plumley from New Revolution Music Promotions and Cherry Star from British-American glam rock group It Sucks. And we also have Philomena Prempe and Max from the Bristol branch of the Aetherius Society.
We have features from Anthea Page and Tony Gosling. Malcolm Grieve reads us another instalment of Lady Stanhope's Travels, and we have poetry by Tim Burrows. Jess Sparks is also here with his What Song Guide and Song of the Week. I'm Michaela Dennis.
And I'm John Peters Coleman. It's my pleasure to introduce Jamie Plumley of New Revolution Music and Cherry Star of It Sucks. Hello to you both. Jamie, you've been on before. Tell me a little bit about New Revolution Music.
New Revolution, we've been going now for pretty much a year and a half. Been working quite solid at it. We've just done a three-day event called Twisted Delusions, which was very successful. We had the likes of... we had a punk day. We've kind of had a new wave kind of rock day. It's a bit of everything, really. We're due to come back with Twisted Delusions too.
Okay. So this is like a sort of multi-day gig event.
Yeah.
Lots of bands going on.
Yeah, lots of bands, lots of different genres and stuff. Kind of everything. It's all a bit mad. Everything's kind of a bit, well, that's why we call it Twisted. It's all a bit sort of different. So hence, yeah, there's kind of like small events held in like sort of pubs and clubs and stuff. And we're hence like we're going to bring it back again. We're looking at either November time or even early next year or so.
Okay. You brought a rock star along with you, Jamie. It's not every day I get to say this, so it's my pleasure to welcome Cherry. Hello.
Hello.
Where are you from?
The band is based in LA, but I'm originally from Las Vegas.
Okay. It takes a little bit of an accent.
My dad is from Quebec, Canada.
Ah, okay. Right, that explained. Okay. So what is it like to be in a band in LA? How would you describe that to somebody who just lives in a little place like Bristol?
Well, you have a lot of competition, that's for sure.
Yeah.
It's like, oh my God, could you have like more bands around? But it's also very fun because you get a lot of friends and generally you get given free alcohol and free a lot of other stuff, which I shouldn't really mention on air.
Yeah. You got pink hair. Well, I'm trying to think to a British audience, you know, who that would probably look quite glam. You've got quite a glam look going on. So is that
We're glam sleaze.
Glam sleaze.
If I had to describe us, we're a bit like a dirtier version of Motley Crue. We got a bit of like Poison going on as well, but we're very bad people.
Very bad people. What's the worst thing you've done?
Depends what's the censorship of the radio show.
Explain it in a sort of a roundabout way in case, you know, an auntie or somebody delicate was listening, but, you know.
The worst thing we've done is... we had a gig and we had about 350 people and we pretty much decided we're not cheersy people, so we just decided to take turns loving each other.
Okay. Well, I think that gives a fair, mental image of...
I mean, it wasn't all 350, but it was quite a few.
Okay. So what sort of an audience do you tend to get? Is this sort of middle-aged businessmen wishing to relive their love of 70s and 80s, or do you get a lot of young kids or a mixture of both?
Mainly we get younger people because they're... what to put it, more lonely. But we do get some older people, but they tend to just call us names and tell us we should find Jesus in us.
So is that quite common?
Very much so. I've had quite a few Bibles thrown at me, been called a heathen as well, but it's all fun.
Right.
I'm in a glam band, I'm prepared.
That's amazing. To a British audience, that would seem quite ridiculous. Does that seem ridiculous to you, or do you just sort of take it in your stride and think, oh, well?
I pretty much knew what's going to happen because it's like, oh my God, like, we're pretty
much... So is that why you do it? Do you do it to get the reaction?
I just find it funny. Like, our lead singer sometimes, like, gets naked on stage to provoke people, so I just find it all funny.
And what do you play?
I play bass.
Okay. Were you originally a bassist? Is that your first love as an instrument?
No, originally I was an, adult dancer.
Okay.
But it doesn't pay well.
Okay.
So I'm quite short.
Really? Okay. That
doesn't work.
Jamie, you're looking like beside yourself, like you want to burst out laughing at various points there. But tell me, you had a Mongrels of Rock events that we interviewed you about last year, and you're doing that again.
This is the third year running. It's all kind of really starting to take off now, obviously, since the first Mongrels of Rock. Every year has been a massive progression, hence It Sucks coming along as well.
Okay.
It is more of a glam based this year. We're kind of going back to the 80s.
Okay, so hence our rock star.
Yeah. It's going to be full of absolute wows this year. There's going to be lots and lots of different things going on. I mean, it's just, I don't know, it's just immense to say.
So tell us a little, where are the other sort of bands you've got?
We've got Priest Unleashed, which is Bristol Western based. Absolutely, they sound alike, they look alike. They're just absolutely brilliant. We've got The Outsider as well playing for us, which they're doing a special 80s set for us because they're normally just kind of an originals band. So it's like they've done this especially for us. So we're absolutely chuffed with that. We've got It Sucks, which apparently as well, which I'd been told by Cherry, that they've got backing singers as well. They've kind of brought along their backing band as well. So we're not just kind of doing some things on a small scale. We're bringing this right up.
Absolutely, yeah.
We've also heard that they're bringing along their photographer as well and stuff. So we kind of like...
This is going to be full on.
Yeah, this is like proper setup this year. This is like...
So to any Bristol locals who have ever visited the Griffin Pub, which is where a lot of heavy music tends to take place, I'm assuming that it's going to be far too small for your event.
It's going to be held at the Tunnels, but what we're planning to do, yeah, we're trying to make this out to be the biggest thing ever in Bristol.
Yeah.
People need to understand that like this is a charity event and we're going full on this year.
Okay, so tell me about the charity.
The charity itself, it was originally for Dogs Friends, but now decided because the event is now starting to grow, we're now doing Macmillan and Alzheimer's involved with it as well. So it's like not just the one charity anymore, it's a couple of charities now that have done this for as well. So, and the tickets are extremely cheap this year. It's back to £5.50. At the end of the day, it's like, you know, who cannot afford a fiver really to come to a really good gig. So
okay, so you're doing something for charity, Sherry. This is maybe I don't know, some sort of, you can gain some more moral high ground to take away from all the terrible things that you've done.
Yeah, it's like, oh my god, so many people like have already told me they're like offended because we're on the bill. But it's like, I look forward to it. It's like, we don't do many charity gigs. And it's kind of my way of redeeming myself, kind of in Britain.
So what sort of lyrical themes are your songs about that make them so bad? Why are you so offensive?
We're talking pretty much about loving each other, about doing substances that you shouldn't be doing, and stuff like that, like booze.
Okay.
But I believe in charity. I believe in New Revolution because they're a very good company. Like, they contacted us and told us they're willing to, like, take slander if they have to for us. So that kind of makes me love them.
Is it kind of like a way of making yourself stand out from the competition in Las Vegas? Is that sort of probably where it came from?
Well, I grew up in Las Vegas, so I grew up around strippers and exotic dancers. So to me, it's quite normal to be half naked.
Yeah, okay. Do you think the British audiences are going to be harder to shock, perhaps, than your, you know, in Las Vegas, you get Bibles thrown at you.
That's in LA, not Las Vegas. But I don't know. I don't know if the British audience is used to like what we do, but we do promise we will be covered.
In America, you might get a more vociferous reaction, but in British, we might just go really uptight and look very awkward. What if we all go stiff upper lip and look rather awkward and stiff?
Let's just say I know how to relax people, but I do promise we'll try to have a cleaner image for this gig because it's for charity.
Okay, that's fair enough. Tell me a little bit more about Jamie, about New Revolution as a sort of a company, you know, you're sort of trying to make this more sort of official and build it up. What does that really mean?
Well, at present, I'm going through the job centre. They're going for a company called Outset because I'm really dead serious now about getting this thing officially live and properly going. Within the company, I've already kind of like set up a photographer through Jeff Sparks himself. He's working for us, taking all the photographs for the events and stuff. I've also got like a team working underneath me to actually set up their own events. For the people who've never set up a gig before, it's kind of a big importance for us to kind of support them and show them how the ropes are sort of set and how it's all going. We're looking to, in time to come as well, make a section sort of more looking to the younger generation and trying to bring the younger generation into the music side of things, on the preparation side of things.
So those sort of under the drinking age.
Yeah, yeah. So we're kind of expanding this in a kind of a bit of a unique and a bit of a different way. We're looking just basically to try and sort of get our sort of teeth now into like the bigger gigs and stuff around Bristol. We've been given access now to the Reckless Engineer to do some gigs down there, which for Revolution, it's like a big thing.
Brilliant.
Seeing as though we've got the Griffin and we've got like Reckless as well.
Okay, so tell me where people can find out about New Revolution music if they're inspired by what you said.
If you're interested in Mongrels of Rock or New Revolution music, if you pop onto Facebook and just type in New Revolution music, promotions, events and management, you'll find us.
Yeah.
You'll find me. My name is Jamie Plumley. Just type my name in.
Excellent. And It Sucks. That's spelled ITSUX.
Yes.
Okay.
If you Google us, you'll find Reverb Nation, MySpace, or if you Google Harley Skull, that's our autobiographer, he will give you one of our free demos to download. So...
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Well, Cherry and Jamie, thank you very much for coming
in.
It's been a pleasure.
It's right in the middle of Bristol's old city centre and dates back to the 1700s. Dialect's Tony Gosling met up with Christchurch in Bond Street's church warden Roger Metcalf to find out something about the history of Bristol's only church in the city centre that still has a thriving congregation.
I'm Roger Metcalf. I'm one of the church wardens at Christchurch with St Ewan, All Saints and St George in Broad Street in Bristol.
Now, we're right up the top of Broad Street, and a lot of people go backwards and forwards past here every day. Well, can you tell us a bit about the history of it? How has this evolved, this particular building?
Well, this is a second or third building on the site, in fact. This one was consecrated in 1792, so it's a Georgian building. And it took over from one which was in a very dangerous state and was pulled down in 1784, I think. We merged with St Ewan's Church, which is across the road, and was pulled down to build the old council house, which is now the registry office. We've been a thriving church ever since 1792. We still use the 1662 Book of Common Prayer and the King James Bible. And in fact, this year we celebrate 350 years of the Book of Common Prayer. Last year we celebrated 400 years of the Bible.
The thing is, nowadays, not a lot of people live in the city centre, and you've got quite a lot of churches here.
We only have two churches in the city centre, St Stephen's down the road and Christchurch. All the rest have been made redundant over the years. All Saints Church across the road is the Diocesan Resources Centre. St John's Church is closed. The other churches in the city were bombed during the last war, and the shells still stand, and that's about all. We're actually the only thriving church in the old city, and our congregations come from great distances. I live out in the Chew Valley. We have people come in from Winterbourne, from all sorts of places, and they come here because they like the form of service that we do. We're very traditional. We don't go with a happy-clappy type of service at all. We come for peace and quiet and to worship God.
There's obviously a massive great organ towering over the church, and we've got these various diamond emblems. They look like coats of arms, this kind of thing. What are they?
Well, the organ, in fact, came from the old church, so it's actually older than this building, as are the bells which are above it in the tower. But it was built originally by Renatus Harris. The case is dated 1682. It's been much updated since then, and it's now in the care of Roger Taylor, who's a local organ builder who lives at Burrington. We have a very good organist, Jonathan Price, who's also our director of music. And we have a choir of men and boys who sing at Sunday services.
What about these diamond coats of arms?
Yeah, they're hatchments, in fact. They're funeral hatchments from the Tyndall family. And we had them restored to their former glory a couple of years ago. They were blackened by an incendiary bomb which came through the church in the Second World War. And until... Well, 2 years ago, you couldn't see any colour at all in some of them. I said the funeral hatchments of the Tyndall family. The Tyndall family actually built the Royal Fort and were a wealthy banking family. Their bank was in Clifton, and Bristolians will know Tyndall's Park Road, Tyndall's Avenue, all named after the Tyndall family.
So where is the Royal Fort?
It's now part of the university, and it's in Clifton, in Tyndall's Park Road. I think, from memory, it's part of the School of Physics. It's certainly opposite the University Library.
Okay, what about the clock on the front?
Well, the clock is actually fairly modern. The clock was, I think, put in this last century. Until very recently, when we took them down for redecoration, to be two quarter jacks that strike bells every quarter hour.
So what are quarter jacks then?
Well, they're Roman soldiers. I don't know what their history is or where they came from originally. They're owned by the city, and we rent them for the great sum of 2 and 6 pence old money every year. And we get a bill for 13.5p for the privilege of having them. Unfortunately, we have to repair them as well, and their present repairs are probably going to cost us £4,000 or £5,000.
Well, that's a bit cheeky of the council, isn't it, to be renting them to you and yet they're expecting you to fix them up?
Well, that's the way the cookie crumbles. The arrangement was made many, many years ago before costs, of course, became extortionate.
So when are they going to be back there?
I don't yet know. They're with a conservator. Dawson's, the steeplejacks, took them down about 6 weeks ago. And we're waiting there for the conservators to redecorate them. So we can put them back up.
Well, it's like quite a lot in this city, unfortunately, isn't it? We're a very historic city. For example, another thing I was talking about a couple of weeks ago is St. John's Conduit, which has been going for 700 years. And for the first time for 700 years, that's also stopped working. Two or three years ago, when Bristol Water came in and did a load of waterworks in the city centre, and even though the council has responsibility for that, there seems to be no efforts to get it going. So how do you think we can try and maintain some of our history? Because it seems to be sort of almost falling between two stools, where it seems that it's slipping and being neglected a little bit.
You're absolutely right, of course. I didn't know about St. John's Conduit. There was a history written recently, wasn't there? Well, I didn't know it had stopped. As far as the quarter jacks are concerned, we have responsibility for them, and they'll go back. We might need to raise some money to get them back up on the front of the building, but so be it. There's such a shortage of money at the moment from the local authority, we can't ask them for money. And you can only really apply to trusts who do have money to support these sorts of causes. We know of a few trusts who will help us, we think, and that's where the story ends, really. This building alone costs us an awful lot of money to keep open every year. We desperately need to decorate it, and that's probably going to cost us £50,000 or £60,000. We're trying to get some disabled access into the building because of the steps, and that's going to cost us probably £100,000. It's a question of you have to go and raise money, and you have to be determined to do it. And if you're not determined and committed, well, these things fall into disrepair, don't they? English Heritage used to help, but they have no money left, I think, now. Their grants have been reduced by the government because of the public purse is not as full as it used to be.
Can you just remind us when the place is open, if people are interested in popping in and having a look around? Because obviously it's not open all the time, as many churches in cities are nowadays. They're not open all the time.
Yeah. I mean, if the best time to come and see us is on Doors Open Day, of course, in September, when the church is open all day long with many others. But generally speaking, we're open on Sundays for services, and people are very welcome to those. Our morning service starts at 11 o'clock, and our evening service starts at 6:30. Other than that, we're open on Tuesday lunchtimes and Wednesday lunchtimes for organ recitals, and again on Thursdays for another communion service, as we've just had.
That was Roger Metcalf, Church Warden of Christchurch Broad Street, the only thriving congregation in the old city centre. The church also has almshouses in Bristol city centre that sometimes become available, but the Bristol City Council refused to marry up with the housing list. So if you know of anyone of faith who needs somewhere to live, please do contact Roger via the church for further details. That's Christchurch on Broad Street. I'm now joined by Philomene Prempe and Max Griffiths from the Bristol branch of the Aetherius Society. Welcome.
Thank you for coming in.
First of all, you're going to have to tell us, what is the Aetherius Society? Because I have never heard of it before.
Well, the Aetherius Society is a worldwide organisation. It's a spiritual, metaphysical and educational organisation founded in 1955 by Dr. George King, who is known as a master of yoga, but not the yoga of postures or exercises, the deeper mystic states of yoga. And we're based throughout the world, United States, England, Africa, Australia, New Zealand, and some parts of Europe. And we're focused on the upliftment and healing of mankind through many, many ways. Healing, teaching, lectures, and many, many other activities as well. So, yeah, we're based all around the world and going quite strongly.
Great. What are the kind of teachings of the Aetherius Society? What do you believe?
We believe as well there's life on other planets in this solar system. And we do get teachings from them. And they come on this planet to show themselves by using what we call UFO, flying saucers. And that they are vehicles which they use to travel through space. And they have been communicating with the founder of the Aetherius Society, Dr. George King, to give messages to mankind, mainly to warn mankind that we are destroying ourselves by using all sorts of nuclear experimentations. And later on, we pollute water, food, air we breathe, which cause most of the time a lot of illness like cancer.
So primarily it's environmental issues.
Yes.
And what do you as a society then do with those teachings? How is that then disseminated, and what action do you take around those teachings?
We are believers in prayer, the power of prayer, dynamic prayer to be exact. And this isn't prayer which is known throughout the world with the hands clasped together. We pray with the hands, with the arms outstretched either side, with the palms facing forward. It's a metaphysical act, and prayer is a request for energies, universal life forces. So a request is made, and we send this energy to either someone who may be sick and may be needing healing, a place at war, places of famine, places of natural disaster. This energy is radiated by human beings, literally as channels, as kind of transmitting stations, if you will. And prayer is one of the greatest weapons we have against a lot of the problems on the earth. Because we're taught by Dr. King that there's one energy crisis on earth, which is the spiritual energy crisis. And all other crises stem from this. But not because the energy is not there. It's because mankind's forgotten how to use it. So the cosmic teachings tell us how to fix this. Dr. King tells us how to fix this. And prayer is one of the greatest means. And also an awful lot of teaching and lecturing as well. Teaching people how they can do these things as well, you know.
So it's about generating positive energy.
Yeah, very much, very much.
And we also teach people how to heal themselves. That's another kind of activity we do to help mankind.
So when you say heal, do you mean spiritually within themselves or physically?
Physically.
Okay.
Mainly because the illness, disease, as we call it, is meaning is the body, the soul, the spirit, they are not in harmony. And then we have to teach people how to harmonize those three aspects of a human being. So when it's, they know, then you can help yourself or help your family, even animals and the plants.
Okay. Tell me more about the cosmic beings, because I think that's probably where people would most struggle with this. It seems so expansive and huge, and the universe and anything like that. People go, crikey. Yeah. What do you mean by cosmic beings, and how are they communicating?
Yeah. Well, we're talking about beings that live literally on the other planets in this solar system, and they exist on higher spheres of existence, higher levels of vibration. We're taught that all life is existing on some level of vibration or other, and the cosmic masters exist on a much higher vibration than we do. They're highly advanced spiritually and scientifically, and they've watched us throughout our existence, and they've watched our mistakes. So they know that we desperately need their help and guidance. We're kind of the bottom class of the solar system on this Earth, whereas Venus, Mars, Saturn, all the other planets are higher classrooms. And these great teachers, these great cosmic masters, have literally come to teach us, to guide us, to uplift us, to stop us making such dreadful mistakes, such as mucking around with atomic energy and hydrogen bombs and these kind of war and creating disease. So they're great teachers, great advanced beings, humanoid in appearance, but if they don't want to be seen, they won't be seen. If they do want to be seen, then you'll see a flying saucer or something in the sky.
So they're benevolent at their...
They're very compassionate. The kind of, I think the fire that spurs them on is compassion. Compassion for us lower beings who are making so many mistakes. Definitely compassionate beings, and very, very wise as well. They've given us a lot of wisdom.
So what is your kind of evidence? Obviously, you mentioned your founder. How did he evidence and show people these first teachings that were communicated to him? How did it all start?
When he was young, he worked so hard, what we call yoga. It's not yoga or physical yoga. It's a form of higher yoga, which is Raja yoga. And he worked about 8 hours per day for 10 years. It's like our mind is like a radio receptive. You receive and you communicate. So he tuned himself so much that the people from other planets, they say we can use his voices to give our message to mankind, to remind them. It's nothing new, it's to remind them. So they use his voices. And then mind they have to ask him his permission, whether he like it or not. Mm-hmm. And he can say, yes, you can use me. When you finish, you go. Which that's what they have done. And they choose only one person, him only, so that there is no confusion if there are so many mediums. One can say whatever it is, whatever they believe. But they choose only him so that their teachings are not confused. There is no confusion and there is no mistake in them or be changed, like other teachings which has been changed for so many centuries.
Do you find with a single founder like George King that people... that kind of raises a cynicism in certain people, you know, the single person in charge and having kind of got this message and is the only person communicating it. it can seem quite worrying for some people. So how do you kind of explain that?
Yes, there have been criticism, I agree with you. But again, we always ask, use your logic, the logic. Everything's logic. If whatever he says has no logic, reject it. If there is a logic, take it and study more and find out more and then learn. That's all about.
So you just kind of rebut that with look at the teachings, take a look for yourself, don't prejudge, and then see what you think afterwards.
That's correct.
Okay. Yeah, we never just say, just take our word for it. It's our doors are open for people to investigate, and that's all we ask. Come and find out what we're about. Come and investigate our activities. Come and buy some of our books if you wish. And we're approachable in many ways, so just come and investigate, and we can probably guarantee you'll come to some startling conclusions yourself. Yeah, but we certainly don't dictate, we don't recruit, we don't push our beliefs onto anybody.
Would you say that you are a religion, or are you something different? How would you describe yourself?
Well, we believe there's only really one religion, and that's an acknowledgement, a belief in God, or the divine, or truth. And we recognise all major religions as different paths to that truth, whether it be Muslim, Christianity, Hinduism, Buddhism. They're all trying to get to the eventual destination. So it's just truth. Truth is the only religion. Truth that will get you back to that source, that divine creative source, the creator of all life. And it's simple as that, really. And we're told the greatest truths are the simplest. So it's truth is the only religion.
Indeed.
Okay, so if someone would like to find out more, do you have a website that they could go to?
Yeah, the website is www.etherius.org. You can check out all the worldwide happenings on there. There's an online store as well. To find out about us specifically, you can go to World Centres, click on that, and then click on the Bristol branch, and you'll find out about all our local events. We're doing a lot in Bristol the next couple of months, exhibitions and talks, some of which are at Arnold's Vale, the new establishment there. We'll be talking about UFOs and life on other planets. There's our phone number, our email address. If you're interested, get in touch anyway, and we'd be happy to have a chat with you.
Great. Well, thank you very much for your time, Philomena and Max, and hopefully we'll have you on again soon.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, the weather has improved in recent times, and hopefully, you know, we will have a lovely summer. According to the forecasters, we are supposed to, and the countryside, when it is lovely, is of course at its most glorious. So, assuming that we do continue to have some sunshine, why not take advantage of Britain's wonderful scenery and join a walking festival? Our reporter Anthea Page was in Winchcombe this weekend and joined a walking festival organised by the community to help bring in more trade and people into the town. It's a very successful event which you'll hear about next week. This week we hear how a local farmer has diversified by renting out his redundant farm buildings to local businesses. It's not often, in fact, you find a farmer with a gym and a fantasy food outlet alongside cows and manure. So let's go down at that point to the farm in Gloucestershire with Anthea Page.
I'm in Harmington Court Farm. I'm with the farmer, Mike Hill. Hello.
Good morning.
You're going to show us your cellars, which are very old, I believe.
Around about 1153.
Fantastic. So should we go down then?
Right, all these old doors are not very tall, as you can see.
So how tall do you reckon that door is? 4'6"?
It's in 5 foot anyway.
We've opened a door and there's some steps leading down.
I just wonder how many people have walked down these steps over the generations. You can see how worn they are.
I go down the worn steps into a passageway.
You've got just cobbled stone here, you see, with mortar. All these old houses, they've got no foundations like today. They're just built on stonework.
But it's very dry.
Well, it can. We've got a drain in. There's a drain there. And when the water table comes up, sometimes we get floods in here, and then it'll go down again.
So what would have this been used for in the old days?
It's almost like a fireplace there. Originally, there was a fireplace down here. What, I got quite sure.
Do you know the history of the farm at all?
Well, as I say, it was owned by Tewkesbury Abbey, and we don't know when Henry VIII sold the abbey to the people of Tewkesbury. He sold the farm, but suddenly it came into ownership of big landowners. We've gone back quite a long way now, and the Cravens and the Barclays, old established landowners, farmed this land back in the 16th, 17th century.
Because the Barclays land stretched almost to Bristol.
Oh, yeah, and it goes up to the other way to Worcester, you see. They had a tremendous area of land. This beam is still very, very hard. Obviously, it's the original, so it's nearly 1,000 years old when you think about it.
Is that oak, then?
No, I think it's elm. Oh. They think a lot of these old beams were elm.
What's under there? Should we go under the beam and have a look?
Whether years ago there actually was a fireplace in here, we don't really know. But obviously the house was gutted down to the height of the cellar and then rebuilt in 1600.
Oh, fantastic. Well, we can barely stand up in here. What were you saying about the mice upstairs?
The flagstone floor in the front room, obviously that is part of the original house because that is just sitting on sand. And where the mice have been going under there for generations, their backs had rubbed the bottom of the stone, so there was actually a ridge underneath the stones where they continually run through there.
I noticed that on the very old handrail that's in on the main staircase, one of the corner pieces is worn. Is that where people have put their hands on it for centuries?
Well, again, when we did the house up, they reckon they took 30 coats of paint off of that staircase to get back to the originals. Well, it's probably as old as the rebuilt house was, so it's probably 400 years old.
So did you find anything else interesting when you were doing up the farmhouse?
No, we found bits of magazines from 1840, seed catalogues and things, but nothing, we didn't find any treasures.
Another interesting thing you mentioned was a jail upstairs. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, this is Pammington Court, though it's been added on Pammington Court Farm now, but it was Pammington Court, so the magistrate would come round, I don't know whether it would be monthly or what, and if they'd got any prisoners in, they put them in this room up on the roof, which we call the Black Hole of Calcutta, because it's about, well, about the same height as this cellar is, so it's about 6 foot. It's about 4 or 5 foot deep and 4 or 5 foot wide, and that's where they used to put them. And the old door is still on there with a wire grill and a great big old lock.
So what would happen to these prisoners? Oh,
they were fined a shilling for an affray or pinching a sheep or something like that. Well, you think in 1600 a shilling was probably a heck of a lot of money. Pammington Manor in the 17th century was worked by 12 yeoman farmers and husbandmen who had an average holding of 40 acres each. By the late 17th century, there were 6 farmers and corn was the most important enterprise. Later still, holdings ranged from 38 to 118 acres and land became divided up equally between tillage and pasture, with cider orchards also important locally. And then it goes on to say how times have changed and what we're doing. We've still got some old trees, but we're in a stewardship scheme where we're planting 100 native fruit trees of Gloucestershire, which are cider, berry, eating apples, cooking apples, plums, all out there. So that's been going on now for 5 or 6 years. We do about a dozen trees a year.
Wonderful. So these are the really old trees,
yeah,
going back in history.
Yeah, yeah.
We're looking now at a plan of the farm. It's vast, isn't it? How many acres is this? 400 acres.
You see, the farmhouse is there. And then we've got a main road along here, a farm road up through there, and the main road down there. So we can get to nearly all the fields without having to go through another field.
So it's mainly beef?
No, no, no. We do 200 acres of corn, flock of sheep. And then there's the beef.
So we're now going into one of the buildings on the farm, which is called Food is Art. And this is an entrepreneur. What's her name?
Emma Prudence State, her name is.
recently made a portrait of the Queen with 2,000 cupcakes.
So she does gifts at weddings, these what she calls wedding shoes. Here's the skulls of Damien Hirst. There's the World Cup football cup. And then, of course, the big thing is these vodka shots made out of chocolate. You fill them up, you drink the vodka, and then you eat the cup.
We're looking at gold Oscars here made in chocolate and a painting by Van Gogh in chocolate.
Well, that's sort of all out of pizza and stuff. There's her chocolate fireplace there. And there's an Arga cooker. You see, this is what Fortnum and Mason. £20 a go. And you play Jenga, and then you eat them.
Looking at the photos on the wall, this is life size in chocolate.
It's all life size, yeah. Full size Arga cooker. I mean, it weighed about 200 kilos when they took it away, and then they had to assemble it. You know, they melt some chocolate and stick it all together when they get there.
Is it made on a frame or just pure chocolate?
Oh, it's pure chocolate. She'll make a frame up to put it in until it's set, yeah.
It's amazing. Doesn't it melt on the
journey? No, because she puts glycerine in it, and it stops it melting.
This is quite incredible.
She goes all over the world. She's off to New Zealand shortly. She's been to Australia. She's been to America. She's on television quite a lot.
And does she do it all by herself?
No,
or does
she employs part-time people. Just depends how busy they are. But here's the light. Everything there is chocolate.
And they're lit as well. They've got electric chocolate chandeliers.
And look at that.
Oh, well, we're looking at a stamp of the Queen made in cheese. What's that for?
This is for the Cheese Council. It's going to London, and obviously all these things are special items for the Golden Jubilee.
We're just going into another room. Where does the chocolate come from? Oh, it smells very chocolatey in here.
She'll have a load of chocolate come in that's almost by its sell-by date, so it's not really wasted. She gets Belgian chocolate. Cadbury's bring a lot in. She did a huge thing with Smarties, and she had millions of them and things.
Thank you very much to Anthea Page, reporting from the farm down in Gloucestershire.
Time once more for another instalment of Lady Hester Stanhope's Travels, from the book by Virginia Childs and read by Malcolm Grieve. Last week, we heard how Lady Hester was in Damascus and had the idea of travelling to Palmyria, an ancient ruined desert city some 100 miles from Damascus and where no European woman has ever travelled or had ever travelled before. This week, we'll hear how preparations are made for the journey to Palmyria and how Damascus comes under the threat of attack.
Lady Hester Stanhope, Queen of the Desert, by Virginia Childs. The preparations for the journey to Palmyra continued. There were two main difficulties which had to be overcome. Palmyra was surrounded by 20 miles of desert, which had to be traversed. This problem of transport and provisioning was calculable. Thorough planning of the expedition would ensure they ran no risk of being stranded or of running out of food. The second problem was not so easily solved. The desert was full of unpredictable and hostile Bedouin tribes. Living as nomads, they were completely unanswerable to rule from Constantinople. They were, literally, outside the law. As direct descendants of the Bedou who had lived in the area since pre-biblical times, they quite understandably regarded the desert as their own property and reserved the right to deal with trespassers as they saw fit. The only people they killed on the whole were those rash enough to come into the desert armed and aggressive, but the Bedou were not averse to a spot of robbing, and sometimes liked to take people hostage in return for large sums of money. The desert was therefore not a safe place for a rich foreign lady to be. The first plan Lady Hester hatched, with the help and hindrance of her new friends, was to go to Palmyra under the protection of the Bedouin Arabs. But the Pasha and his ministers objected to this. It was far too dangerous, they said. The Bedou were an untrustworthy lot, and besides, they were the Pasha's enemies. And Suleiman could not let it be thought that they were offering her more hospitality than he himself. She should, he decided, be accompanied by a small body of his own men. who would be heavily armed. Lady Hester was happy to accept the idea, but when the number of her escort was inexplicably raised to 1,000 men, she had to decline his offer, for the expense would have been ruinous. Lady Hester later discovered that he had been threatened by Mahanar, the chief of the Anizi tribes of Bedou Arabs, who owned the land on which Palmyra was built. Although the balance of power in the desert was always in a state of flux, Mahanar was the most powerful leader in the whole area, and a considerable force to be reckoned with. The Bedou chief had threatened to cut off the Pasha's beard and strip all his men naked if he took Hester into the desert. He said the desert was his, so the honour of escorting Lady Hester should be his also. Rather than risk his beard and total humiliation, the unheroic Pasha speedily withdrew his offer to accompany Hester to Palmyra, leaving her once more undecided about her plans. The Pasha had other things on his mind, more pressing perhaps than Lady Hester's schemes. Whilst he had been negotiating with her, an alarming rumour had been heard that 40,000 Wahhabis, led by the famous Ibn Saud, were on the march from the Arabian Peninsula. They were said to be ransacking and burning every village on the way, and their destination was Damascus. The Wahhabis had tried to take Damascus once before, and had only been repulsed after a furious battle. The Pasha was extremely worried, especially because he had dissension in his own ranks. He had somehow managed to offend his Deli Bakas, who were under the command of the son of the previous deposed Pasha. The infantry, who were composed of Albanians, were on the present Pasha's side, and relations between the two vast units of men were tense. "Every day a battle is expected," Lady Hester wrote in October. The situation was made even more volatile by the fact that the Anizis, the strongest group of Bedouin Arabs, disliked the current Pasha and automatically joined any faction who opposed him. The threat of the Wahhabis may have helped to prevent the internal squabble from erupting, however, for if they attacked, they would be indiscriminate in whom they killed, Delibach or infantryman. The outcome was rather an anticlimax. Lady Hester told the Pasha she was sure that no Wahhabis would materialise, and as usual, she was right. The argument between the Pasha and his Delibachis was resolved, and order was restored.
That was Lady Hester Stanhope's Travels by Virginia Charles and read by Malcolm Grieve.
It is my pleasure to welcome Tim Burrows to the studio again. Hello.
Hi.
So, have you been out in the sunshine writing more tunes?
Yes, I'm trying to put together a CD of music guitar compositions.
Okay.
And it's going to be called The High Vaulted Ceiling. I've been trying to do some artwork for it and discomposing, and it's great. And I was sitting out there in the sun this afternoon trying to work some pieces.
So these are instrumentals, are they?
Yeah.
Okay, and what was the reference to the title?
Well, The High Vaulted Ceiling, it's almost like music kind of takes us to a kind of a higher place. It's like one of the best things we do, you know, and also given that, you know, standard religion has kind of fallen away, people look to art and music for kind of inspiration and something to hold on to when things aren't so good. So.
Okay, so High Vaulted Ceiling is in a sort of cathedral sense.
Yes, but something beyond. I've got this idea of a ceiling, like a vaulted ceiling from the cathedral, but putting clouds in the top. So you look at this standard thing, and then there's clouds. So it's kind of...
Okay.
Yeah.
How many tracks in total are you thinking about writing?
I don't know. I'm going to put some on SoundCloud. I've got about probably 20 working pieces, but I'm kind of trying to knit them together.
Okay. And can people find that under your own name, Tim Burrows?
Yeah, and they're going to put them up on SoundCloud. At the moment, I'm just getting to know SoundCloud, so there will be some up there.
There will be some, okay.
Yeah.
So what is the piece called that you're going to play for us now?
The piece is The Passing Torch. It's sort of a reference to the Olympic torch, but, you know, which has gone through today. So.
And yeah, and ran straight past our studio, in fact.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, let's hear it. Thank you. Well, Tim Burrows, thank you very much. And importantly, are you playing any gigs soon? Can people come and witness your magnificence?
Well, I'll be doing some more shows through Mark Venus, but I'm going to do my Folk Word and Whimsy is going to be the fourth Sunday this of next month. So Under the Stars boat. So
the Under the Stars Cafe Bar, which is right in the centre of the city, nearby where the fountains, fourth Sunday of next month.
By the falafel van.
By the falafel van. You can come and see Tim. Thank you.
Thanks.
It's that time of the week again where we welcome Jeff Sparks with the What's On Guide and Song of the Week. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, Michaela. This is a What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Thursday, 31st of May, Help for Heroes Metal Fest 2, featuring headliners Heaven Asunder and with support from Depths, Roads to Nowhere at Dakota Ruins and of Kings and Cardinals, will all be performing in the main room at the Croft in Stoatscroft, Bristol. Entry is £4 on the door, or £3.50 if you dress up as a zombie, and doors open at 6:30 p.m. All money raised goes to Help for Heroes. Also on 31st of May, Made to Waste will be launching their debut EP, Bones for the Cause, at the front bar of the Croft in Bristol, with support from Malicious Intent, Inimissus, Rager and Throne of Demise. Entry is £4 on the door and doors open at 6:30 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Rival Sons. This group formed in 2008 in Los Angeles, California, and to date have released 2 studio albums and 1 EP. This is from the recent album Pressure and Time, which was released in 2011, and is the song Gypsy Heart.
Another
That was Rival Sons with Gypsy Heart from the album Pressure and Time. For more information, you can check out www.rivalsons.com. Into Friday, 1st of June, Talking Heads tribute Speaking in Tongues will be performed at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £4 in advance and £5 on the door, and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Finally, on Saturday, 2nd of June, Skid Row tribute Subhuman Race will be performing a two-hour set of Sebastian Bach-era Skid Row at the Reckless Engineer in Temple Gate, Bristol. Tickets are £5 in advance and doors open at 8 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you, Jeff.
That's all from Dialect for this week. Thank you very much to our guests, Jamie Plumley of New Revolution Music, and also Sherry Starr of It Sucks. We also had Philomena Prempe and Max from the Aetherius Society, and features were by Anthea Page and Tony Gosling. We also had Tim Burrington, who played us an instrumental on his lovely guitar, and he's taking part at a poetry film event next Thursday, towards the end of the month, and that is in Queen Square. There's an arts club in Queen Square just opened. Couldn't remember the name of the arts club, unfortunately, but if you look up Poetry Film on Facebook, that is the event. You'll be able to find it.
We also had another instalment of Lady Stanhope's Travels, read by Malcolm Grieve, and we had the What's On Guide by Jeff Sparks. The engineer this week was Michael Noyce, and the producer was Jeff Sparks. I've been Michaela Dennis.
And I've been John Peters Coleman.
Take care and goodbye.
Bye-bye.